welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show this morning, we'll be talking with John Berendt. I think a lot of people will know him for his book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. It was a big bestseller. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, sold more than 2.5 million copies in hardcover. It was a very popular book. And he explains that almost as soon as that book was published, people started asking him, what will you write about next? And he started thinking about the possibility of finding another city that would have the same sort of mix of mystery and atmosphere and eccentric characters that Savannah did. And apparently he managed, because he has a new book out. It's been out now just a couple of months, that is similar in some ways, about a city that is similar in some ways, although on the face you might think it was a place that was very different from Savannah. And the place that we're talking about is Venice. His new book is The City of Falling Angels, and it's published by the Penguin Press. It is out now in the bookstore if you would like to read it. And as we talk here this morning with John Berendt, if you'd like to call in and talk with him, you can certainly do that. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. In fact, if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. Here again in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Berendt, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today. We appreciate
it. Glad to.
Did, after the first book was published, did representatives of chambers of commerce from cities around the country line up at your door saying, please, will you please write about our city?
Well, not chambers of commerce, but individuals would say, why don't you come and have a look at our city? But basically, I was looking for a story, and so I was flattered to be asked, but didn't take any of them up on it.
Well, and I guess the reason I mentioned that is people didn't realize that one of the things that result from the publishing of the book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, was a huge boom of tourism for Savannah, Georgia. A lot of people read the book, and then they decided they wanted to go see the city.
Some of them have moved there, too. Many people have moved to Savannah after having gone to see it. Because I don't know of anybody who's been disappointed, who's read the book and thought they wanted to go see Savannah and gone and had a look, but I have not heard of a single case of someone being disappointed, I'm happy to say.
So Venice apparently was a place that before you made the decision that you wanted to spend a significant amount of time there and write about the city, it had been a place that you had visited a number of times.
I was fascinated by Venice. I'd been there maybe a dozen times in the past. So when I was casting about for a place, I thought first of Venice. That was the first thing that came into my mind. I didn't go there, however, until 2 years after Midnight came out, because I was so taken up with all of the pleasant after effects of Midnight and having to go around and talk about it. But I went to have a look at Venice to see if I could find a story that would intrigue me. And 3 days before I got there, of course, the great Fenice Opera House burned to the ground. So that was the beginning of something.
So when you went, you were at that point thinking about possibly writing about Venice, but didn't exactly have the intention right at that point?
Right. I was on a scouting mission. And because I knew, I'd been there often, and I knew a few Venetians, I was able to go from the public Venice that you see as a tourist into a bit of the private Venice. It's very hard, as you know, if you are a tourist, to go into private homes. I mean, it's almost impossible unless you have an introduction. So, and I wanted to write about Venetians and expatriates who live there, basically about people who live in Venice full time. That's something that a tourist, and when I had been a tourist earlier, I couldn't really judge. I see people who were Venetians and who were full-time residents, but I didn't know what their lives were like. I wanted to write a book about people who lived in the city I was writing about, not just about tourists. In fact, somebody noticed, and I hadn't even realized this, but no one in my book, City of Falling Angels, is a tourist. Tourists are there, but they're not really part of the story. They're a factor in the city, a very big factor, because the city is attuned to tourists. But there is a life that goes on in Venice that tourists are not likely to see, and that's what I wanted to get at. So since I had some contacts, I was able to go to see them, talk to them, and then branch out from there to see other people who live in Venice.
Yeah. I was really surprised to learn just how small the full-time, the year-round population of Venice is.
Well, in my book I said it was 70,000. Since then, and I wrote that, not that long ago. Well, actually, it was 70,000 meant in 1996 when I arrived there and the fire had just happened. Now, 9 years later, there are 63,000 people living in Venice, and the simple reason is that it's a town that is cut out for tourism, and that means that the commercial base of the city is gauged to serve tourists. It's restaurants, hotels, museums, gift shops. So young people go elsewhere to find work because it's really a museum city. Life does go on in it. And they're very keen about that they're not a dead city. And they've been called a dead city for 200 years ever since Napoleon defeated the Venetian Republic. They're very intent on living a life in Venice, but they have to admit that it's a very museum type of city.
You mentioned, and you explained in the book, that there is an event that really is the centerpiece, a story that runs through the book that began, that happened just a couple of days before you got there, and that was the fire that destroyed the Opera House. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the building and what it represented to the people of Venice.
Well, the Fenice is, many people thought it was the most beautiful opera house in the world. It was an architectural treasure, that's one thing. It was 200 years old. However, more than that, Venice had once had something like 12 opera houses going at once. The city had been one of the birthplaces of opera, and in the Fenice, there were many, many famous operas that debuted. Five of Verdi's operas were commissioned by the Fenice and debuted on its stage. So it was a real cultural force. But the problem is, when the Fenice burned, there were no more opera houses in Venice. There had been, as I said, about a dozen, but there were none. Not only that, the Fenice, with the loss of the Fenice, there were no major stages in Venice for the performing arts. They really were wiped out as far as the theaters, performing arts were concerned. So they realized that indeed they could be seen as a dead city, because what you had in Venice, a spectacularly beautiful city of marvelous architecture, unique architecture that had been built at least 200 years before, if not 300 or 400 or 500 years before, and wonderful art. And the art was all just that old as well. So it meant that the city really was living on its past. So they realized that the Fenice loss was far greater than the loss of a simple building, a beautiful building. So what it really meant was that Venice was perhaps dying, because the cultural features of the city no longer had a heartbeat. The mayor said, "We must rebuild the Fenice to prove to the world and to ourselves that we are alive as a city." So it really went to the heart of what Venice was all about, this fire at the Fenice. And that's why I felt that it was a really important theme to have through the book. The book is about a lot more than the Fenice, but start with the fire, and then 7 years go by, and other things happen around the fire and contemporaneously with the rebuilding and the investigation into the causes. And the end of the book is the reopening of the completely rebuilt Fenice.
I think it's certainly appropriate that the thing that is the central event was the loss and the reconstruction of the theater, of the city's theater, because there clearly is another sort of theme that runs through the book, the way that people talk about Venice and the feeling of the city. There seems to be a real theatricality about the place.
That's the most salient feature of it.
Yeah. Well, talk about that.
Well, Mary McCarthy said that everybody who goes to Venice thinks they're the first person to notice that the place looks like a painted stage set. And it's absolutely true. There's no other way of describing it. You feel as though you're in an opera. This tends to have an effect on people who live there, because they begin to feel that they're in the midst of their own drama as they go over bridges, as they walk through the city. It does feel as though it's you're on a stage. And in fact, one of the people I spoke with said something that I thought was so important on that theme that I put it as the prologue of the book. The man's name is Girolamo Marcello. and he's from an old Venetian noble family. He's a count. And he said to me, everybody in Venice is acting. Everyone plays a role. And we were walking along the street. He said, how do you see a bridge? And I said, what do you mean, see a bridge? And he said, do you see a bridge as an obstacle, as a set of steps to get from one, to go over, to get from one side of a canal to the other, and there are 450 bridges in Venice. He said, because we Venetians do not see bridges as obstacles. To us, they are transitions. We go over them very slowly. They're part of the rhythm. And when we go over them, our role changes. We go from one reality to another reality. It's like changing scenes in a scenery in a theater. And he said, light reflected from a canal goes up through a window to the ceiling of a room, from the ceiling to a glass, from the glass to a bowl. Which is the real sunlight? Which is the real reflection? He said. And he said, you know, a trompe l'oeil painting is reality once removed. It looks so lifelike, it looks like the real thing, but it isn't. It's reality once removed. In that case, he said, what is a trompe l'oeil painting when it's seen in a mirror? Reality twice removed? He said, what is true, what is not true? You can't be so sure, because in Venice, the truth can change. I can change, you can change. That's the Venice effect, he said. At this point, we were approaching a bridge. And as we went over it, from Calle San Luca into the square on the other side, I looked to see if he would acknowledge any change in role, because he said he changed roles. His role changed to go over bridges. I didn't feel any change in my role, whatever it was. But we got to the other side of the bridge, and we walked into the open square. He looked at me, and he smiled, and he said, Venetians never tell the truth. We mean precisely the opposite of what we say.
Well, that reminds me, there's another wonderful line in here that comes from one of the people that you explained in the book that you decided, rather than stay in a hotel, that you would rent an apartment. And there's a couple that you rented from. I think they lived there in Venice for some time.
30 years.
He was American and she was English. And at one point she says to you, in Venice, no matter what you say, everyone will assume you're lying.
That's right.
And then she goes on and says, Venetians always embellish. They take it for granted that you will too. So you might as well, because funnily enough, if they discover you're someone who tells the truth all the time, they'll simply write you off as a bore.
Yes. This is both. That was Rose Lauritsen telling me that. She was the English lady. And Count Marcello was telling me virtually the same thing. There is a large measure of charm in that. And exaggeration and embellishment. That's what they were both doing. They were both telling me, be skeptical. People in Venice tend to embellish. And in fact, when Marcello was saying, no one tells the truth, we mean the opposite of what we say, he was embellishing, he was exaggerating. And that was sort of understood as he told me that. But there is this, as you mentioned, the theatricality of Venice that does encourage that kind of dramatic embellishment.
When I told people and managed to mention to people that I was going to be talking to and about this new book, it seemed like everyone had this idea that it was a novel, and I had to say to them, no, it's nonfiction. And they would give me this look like, yeah, right.
And I
don't know if that's because they had seen the movie version of Midnight, or that because there was some controversy about your maybe moving events around a little bit. And in this book, in fact, City of Falling Angels, right in the beginning of the book, you say very clearly, this is a work of nonfiction. All of the people in it are real. There are no composite characters. They have their real names.
I'm still thinking
about this business of going back and forth between the truth and some embellishment.
Good time to talk about that. In Midnight, which is also not a novel, and it's nonfiction, I did put a note in there to be perfectly straightforward. I said that this is a work of nonfiction, but I have taken some storytelling liberties. It mostly involved in the timing of events. That isn't to say that any of the stories are made up. They're not. The characters are not made up. There are no composite characters in Midnight or the present book. In Midnight, I did change some names because I just thought that certain people ought to have their privacy maintained. So they were private figures. And when my book came out, many of those people said, why didn't you use my real name? I have to now convince people that I am, in fact, that character. So I thought, okay, that's the end of that. And in this book, The Falling Angels, I didn't use any pseudonyms at all. Everybody's real. It's a never-ending battle with me. For me, I don't know what to do about it. My books are both referred to as novels, but if you check the New York Times bestseller list, it's on the nonfiction list. I don't know what to do. If they read like novels, and that's my intention, and that gets back to the whole nonfiction novel, but mind you, nonfiction novel idea that Truman Capote talked about in Cold Blood and Norman Mailer's The Executioner's Song. Both were written, both nonfiction, written to be read as if they were novels for the entertainment value, for the dramatic sweep of the book. And it's the new. It's also called the new journalism. That Tom Wolfe gave it that name. It's simply a style of writing nonfiction. To write it using the same literary techniques that a novelist or short story writer would use, which is to say, just very very detailed description of places and people, and going further than simply saying. Character X said Y, character Z said something else. You describe the faces, the look in the eye, the reaction of other people, as a novelist would do, and you move from scene to scene, and the action does move that way. In the first book, I simply put the shooting in the middle of the book rather than in the beginning. It had no impact on the veracity of the other stories, but it made the dramatic sweep a lot more... dramatic, in fact, a lot more readable. It was the way to unveil that story. In Savannah, I wanted to introduce Savannah, introduce the reader to Savannah before the murder happened. And the only way to do that was to introduce all the characters and then describe the shooting. In fact, the shooting had happened before I arrived there, but in putting it in the middle of the story, it really didn't change the story whatsoever. In this book, The City of Falling Angels, I didn't move anything around. Everything is chronologically correct, and everything else is true also. If it reads like a novel, that's only because I want it to read like one, even though it isn't one.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, John Barrett. He's a journalist, former editor of New York Magazine. His first book, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, was an international bestseller, also finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in General Nonfiction in 1995. His new book has been out now a couple of months, is The City of Falling Angels, and it's about Venice. It's published by the Penguin Press and certainly available in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. Questions, too, are welcome if you'd like to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have talked a little bit about the fire, the Opera House fire, that it's the story that runs through the book and happened just before you got there. Then you mentioned the fact that right from the start there was among the people of Venice this determination to rebuild the Opera House. There also was a great deal of suspicion about the cause of the fire. Some right from the beginning suspected that it was arson, and then it began to look like probably it was an accident because there was renovation going on at the time. And then there also was a question about, well, was it an accident or not?
Yes. The first suspect for everybody was the mafia. The mafia had already burned an opera house in Italy, in Bari. So they were already targeted as a possible suspect. And, of course, there is this conspiracy thinking that goes on in Italy a lot. However, it was discovered pretty quickly, at least thought pretty quickly by the experts, that the fire had been a combination of negligence and accident. Because this theater was under renovation at the time it burned, there were piles and piles of flammable materials right next to cans and drums of combustible materials. And all you had to have was a cigarette carelessly thrown or a spark from a machine to set the whole thing ablaze. And this is what the experts thought, until they discovered, it was very complicated, but they discovered actually that the fire had been set at two places. So it did look like arson. And not only that, the fire took quite a while to, they thought had taken quite a while to burst into flame. And then finally discovered that, no, it burst into flame immediately. This is technical, scientific evaluation. So if a fire burns grow slowly, they think that tends to be an accident. If it bursts into flame, that is typical of arson. So they determined that it was arson, and they went after two electricians who were a part of a group of seven in a small company doing some subcontracting electrical work. They were behind in their work, and they were facing a small fine, but wasn't small to them, apparently. It's a few thousand dollars. So in order, the theory went, the prosecutor's theory, was that in order to get out of paying the fine, they wanted to burn their work area, and so they would be relieved of that fine and the deadline, and it got out of hand. Well, there was a trial, a very dramatic trial. These two young men, and they were convicted of arson. And at the trial, the interesting thing is, the trial, at the end of it, judge called them into court for the sentencing. He gave one 7 years, the ringleader of the two, and the other 6 years. And then he said something quite amazing. He said to the court, these two young men were not alone. There were others in the shadows who were directing this thing, other people for whom the destruction of the Fenice was a mere trifle compared with what they stood to gain from burning it. And I was amazed, and I went to see the judge afterwards. I said, how could you say such a thing? There had been no evidence entered into court relating to anybody hiding in the shadows directing this fire. And he said, well, I know that, but this is what I think really happened, and the other judges agree with me. So I went to talk to the prosecutor, who by this time had become a sort of friend. I said, what is this all about? He said, we've discussed, you and I, I've been looking for perhaps somebody bigger, someone who stood to make a lot of money rebuilding the Fenice, been looking for, a culprit. And we don't have any evidence, and the two young men aren't talking, but I did suspect that the father of one of them was the link to the money. However, he has just died of stomach cancer, so that's finished. We're not going to pursue it. It's been 7 years. And we have more important things to do now with our resources. For instance, terrorism is one of the things we have to be concerned about. So I went, the next day I saw a Venetian artist, and I said, how frustrating, 7 years of investigation and trial, and two men are convicted, but now we're told by the authorities that there's probably somebody hiding in the shadows who did this. And I said, how frustrating. And the artist said to me, not at all. It's the perfect ending for Venetians. We love it. I said, why? He said, we can make up our own ending, which is what we were going to do anyway. Now we're told that there's a mystery. He said, look what you've got in this story. You have a dramatic fire that destroys a cultural icon. You have all the unseemly rushing around trying to point the finger of blame to other people. And then you have the dramatic trial and a conviction. And finally, a mystery, an official mystery. What more could you ask? Venetians like, you see, they're very comfortable with ambiguity. We are not that comfortable with ambiguity. I like to have the facts. I like to know what happened. But there's a very big difference between American perceptions and Venetian. And as I say, Venetians are very happy with ambiguities, with subtleties, with things that are not so definite. So, that was a big difference, and that's how we wound up. I mean, there were two people who were apparently guilty, but then there was something in the shadows we don't know about.
We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that I guess this is really since the 1950s, the population of the city has declined very dramatically, and at the time of the book, at least starting in 1996, I think you said there were 70,000 people, and that now there are 60-some thousand. So, and that perhaps contributes to another one of the things about the city that makes it the place that it is, and people talk about it as well in the book, is that it seems to have the atmosphere of a small town, one of those places where everybody knows everybody else. Everybody knows everybody else's business, partly maybe because it's a city where everybody walks to get around, so it's very visible. But that perhaps also part of it just is the scale of it and the fact that it really is a relatively, that's smaller than the population of our neighboring town of Champaign here, which we think of as being a small to medium-sized city, 63,000 people.
Also, not just that people walk, but that this the livable part of Venice. I mean, there are some docks areas and some things, areas that are not residential or even commercial. The part of Venice that we know is not even twice the size of Central Park. Central Park, if you know it, is not very big. And indeed, people do have to walk. There are no cars. Gondolas are for tourists. They're too expensive for the people who live there all the time to take. And the same is true of water taxis that are motorboats. So what people do is they walk and they ride on the Vaporetto, which is a water bus. So they see each other all the time. They're either in the street or on a Vaporetto. I mean, and that's a very one of the democratic aspects of Venice, because whether you're a contessa or a charwoman, you're riding the same Vaporetto and walking in the same street. So people mix very easily there. And they see each other all the time, all the time. I mean, I kept seeing people I knew in the street in the Vaporetto. So you do know what's going on and who's in town or who's where. And it does give the place a very small town atmosphere.
Yeah, I think you. One of the it was the same couple, the woman who said to you that all Venetians always lie. I think it was them, of which you said that when she comes home from going to the market, her husband doesn't ask her what did you get for dinner. He said, "Who did you see?"
Right. Now, very often there are more tourists in Venice than Venetians. There's sometimes 100,000 tourists in a given day, but. You do see the Venetians in between all the tourists. And there also are neighborhoods in Venice that are very Venetian and not touristic. And they tend to be on the east or west end of Venice, in Canareggio on the west and Castello on the east. And if you're in Venice as a tourist and you're shuffling along with a lot of other tourists, there are major routes between various important nodes in Venice. One of the nodes, I would say, is St. Mark's Square. Another is the Accademia Bridge. Another is the Rialto, which is the market and a beautiful bridge. And the perhaps another one is the railroad station. And between these nodes, there are very heavily traveled calle and pathways between them. And if you step off those major routes, they don't look like routes, but they are very crowded alleys, kind of. You step off one side or the other, you are in a very quiet neighborhood, and in a neighborhood that is apt to be more Venetian in spirit than these tourist areas.
We are a little bit past the midpoint of this first hour of Focus 580. Our guest, John Barrett, he's the author of Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil. His new book that came out in the fall is The City of Falling Angels, and it's about Venice, and it's published by the Penguin Press. And again, questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The title of the book, amazingly enough, actually comes from a sign, a real sign that was put out in front of a church that was being restored at one point, and they actually put a sign out that said, "Beware of Falling Angels."
Yes, it was the Santa Maria della Salute Church, a very big and prominent church, which you can see. It's the most photographed church in Venice outside of the Basilica. You can see it. It's on the Grand Canal. And there, on top of it, or all around the periphery of the dome and on the pediments, there are many, many, many marble angels, and they were toppling off into the campo below. Someone put a sign saying, "Beware of Falling Angels." And I thought, well, now that's not a bad topic, idea for the title, because indeed, it has several levels of meaning. One of them is literal, because the city is decaying, which is natural for a city that old, and it's being restored. So it's less decay now than before, but it was literal. But also, the title, The City of Falling Angels, is metaphorical, because it refers to people who might think of themselves as doing good works, but who probably are not.
Well, I was thinking about the fact that Venice seems to have and has had for a long time this reputation as being a place that is, in a word, decadent.
Yes. Well, it was. I would say the decadent eras are somewhat in the past. in the 18th century, one of the reasons that Venice fell to Napoleon was that by the 18th century, all they did was gamble and go to houses of prostitution. They'd been a terribly, terribly wealthy republic. I mean, they were a trading giant and very, very rich. And they began to have fun and do all kinds of decadent things, parties. They walked around half the year in masks. Sometimes some people never took the masks off. They owed money, they were hiding from mistresses, whatever. And so they began to lose their power around the world. They began to lose trade to other countries, other cities, and they were weakened, and Napoleon took them over. Now, then from the defeat by Napoleon, which was 1797, for the next 200 years, Venice was extremely poor. And the decadence continued, but on a much smaller scale. But then what happened is that the city became a center for tourists, even in the 19th century. And the tourists themselves were decadent. It was seen as a place to have a party, to live your fantasy, to pretend that you're Casanova, the great lover, who was Venetian, of course. But today, I would say, it's not so decadent as it was before. There are forms of decadence, I would say, in Venice now, having to do with the spending of a lot of money, I suppose. But it's nothing like the decadence of the 18th century.
Yeah. It seems, though, it's going back to this idea of the theatricality that characterizes life in the city, or at least that's people like to think of it that way. They still liked this this metaphor of wearing the mask and playing the part.
Oh, yeah. The masks now are worn as a major tourist item. The masks are worn during carnival, which lasts about 2 weeks. Around February, the day changes. But it's a throwback to the carnival that went on all year long. And during carnival in Venice, it's a very lively time. People wear costumes in the street, and they wear masks, and there are carnival balls, and they do sort of relive the old days, but only briefly. It's a little more buttoned down than it used to be.
I also, I think that particularly the story of not so much the fire, but all of the tangled process involved in rebuilding the Fenice, seems so Italian to me.
It's really quite amazing what they go through, what they put themselves through. As somebody said to me, if you want to fix a crack in the wall of your house, you have to go to get 29 signatures from 24 offices before you get permission. And finally, you have to bribe the official who gives you the final permission. And that very same official would fine you for not making the repair or for making it without a permit. So you can't win anyway. And things take forever. Venetians will always tell you, you can't get anything done in Venice. And I don't know why that is. It may be endemic not just to Venice, but to much of Italy. But in Venice, it's quite remarkable how complicated things can be.
We have a caller here. Let's bring him into the conversation. Someone in Whiteheath on our line number one right here. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was just calling because we were just in Venice before Christmas. And we were enthralled with the city. It's a beautiful place, and there weren't the crowds. I think that's one thing that we were able to just walk around unfettered by massive crowds and those little narrow streets. But let me ask you this: how would you ever get any fire protection? If a building did start on fire, where would the fire department come from or whatever?
Okay. There is a fire brigade, and they have a headquarters with fire boats, many of them, and they're on the Grand Canal, and they zip around to fires. And what they do is they use water directly from the canal.
Okay, all right.
Now, what happened the night the Fenice burned was quite extraordinary because it also made people think there was some kind of plot afoot. The fire occurred at a time when the canal at the Fenice Opera House had been drained. so it could be dredged. So the firemen arrived, and they couldn't get any water. There wasn't any water. So they had to bring water from the Grand Canal, 300 yards away, through these old hoses, to the theater. Now, because of that fire, and because there was no alternative, really no alternative source of water, they are putting in a whole system of fire hydrants.
Okay.
So that's the answer to that. But indeed, fire in the worst threat to Venice is not the water rising, but the fire. It is a very flammable city. It looks as though it's made of stone, but inside the stone is wood. It's a city of wood and velvet.
Yeah, that's, we noticed that it was a lot of velvet.
Yeah.
It is beautiful, and that the just the whole atmosphere is so unusual.
Yes.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Oh, well, thank you for the call. I think that there's one interesting detail among the many things that you learn about Venice from reading the book is that there are no fire hydrants in Venice.
Well, there are now.
Oh, there are.
You're right. There weren't, but now there are here and there fire hydrants, and that's brand new. They weren't there when I wrote my book.
Well, was that a result of the Fenice fire?
Absolutely.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So instead of fire engines, instead of fire trucks, they have fire boats, and they just pump the water right out of the canal.
Right. And then when they do that, you see, they get not such clean water pumped onto these buildings. And also it's salt water. And salt eats away at brick. Hmm. So it's not the best. So they're trying to pump fresh water in.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is John Barrett. His new book is The City of Falling Angels. It's about Venice. He's the author of Midnight and the Garden of Good and Evil. The new book just came out a couple of months ago, published by the Penguin Press. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You mentioned the fact that there is this concern that while indeed fire may be the pressing issue, there is this concern about water. The sea level is rising, and there is some worry that the city eventually, well, I don't know if the city would actually be covered, but if the water gets higher, it's seriously going to be a problem. What are people thinking about doing about that?
Well, they're more than thinking. They were arguing for 25 years over a plan that had been designed to have movable dikes at the three openings in the Lido from the lagoon to the Adriatic Sea. And those would close when the tide got too high. Venice is built more or less at sea level. It varies. St. Mark's Square, as a matter of fact, is the lowest part of Venice, and it floods the easiestly. I mean, it's the first thing to flood. So, and only in especially high tides. Now, with the sea level rising, there's a real danger that the city will be flooded every day at high tide, and then perhaps even more than at high tide. So those dikes will be important eventually. You have to realize, of course, that the Netherlands is below sea level, and their dikes work, and London has a way of controlling the Thames. So, as I said before, that it takes 29 signatures and 24 official offices to get anything done. The Venetians and the Italians have been arguing about whether to build this Moses plan, that's the name of it, and now they finally decided they will do it. The arguments against it are that, number one, it might pollute the lagoon by shutting it off to the sea frequently, and so thereby making it hard to flush itself into the ocean as it always does twice a day. And that so that the environment is one concern about pollution, but also they're afraid that this would be only a temporary solution because the water would rise to a higher level and they'd have to do something else. But they are doing something, and currently they are building these three very interesting movable dikes that come up from the bottom of a lagoon when the sea rises, and they block those three entrances through the Lido into the lagoon.
The book does have this cast of interesting, eccentric characters, as does Midnight. I'm not sure if there's anyone quite like the Lady Chablis, but there are certainly a lot of interesting folks. Is there anything in particular, anyone in particular that among all of these various people that you met that stands out in your mind as someone you would like to tell people about?
Yes, well, it's people who explain Venice to me I find most interesting. But I'll tell you, there is one person who stands for all of, he represents all of what we were talking about, the theatricality. And I would say that person is Mario Moro. And he's a delightful man. He's an electrician. What makes him unusual is that he puts on uniforms of various people on different days. One day he might be a conductor of a vaporetto. I mean, Stanley wouldn't be actually doing it. He'd be standing on the dock, on the landing dock of a vaporetto, and he'd be dressed as a conductor, waving the driver into the dock. He's just pretending. Another day he'd be dressed as a naval officer. Another time as a policeman. I had seen him in several of these outfits, and I finally talked to him, and he actually played the role to himself when he was dressed in these costumes. And eventually I realized he had partial uniforms. He had the jacket of one of an officer in the army and pants that he had worn the day before as a policeman, that sort of thing. But he represented to me an extreme version of the theatricality of Venice. And I asked him what he had done on the night of the Fenice fire. And he said that he was on the Giudecca, which is an island just on the other side of the Giudecca canal from the main part of Venice, and they could all see the fire from there. And he ran home, and he put on his fireman's outfit. And I said, did you go help out, put out the fire? He said, no, my associates did that night. But I was standing on the Giudecca, waving at the helicopters that were picking up water and dumping it on the theater, waving them, giving them instructions. He felt that he was guiding the helicopter pilots toward the Fenice and giving them their orders. Mm. This is all in his head.
And he, as a character, he fits so well into this sort of theme. One is prompted to doubt the veracity, but you assure us that you did not make him up. He is a real person.
He's a very well-known character on the Giudecca Island. When I say the Giudecca Island, it's one of the many islands of Venice. And part of that, the Venice is not even twice the size of Central Park. No, he's well known. He's a figure that people have seen around a lot.
We're talking about the fact that the population, there has been this decline in the population, the fact that now maybe more than ever, although it's not really new, it has been Venice is a city that really relies on tourism for its to make money, for its survival. Is it a city that has a long-term future as a living city, or is it something that is going to be reduced, maybe already has been reduced to a kind of a museum with people who do live there year-round?
This is an open question because this is what Venetians are now most concerned about. What is the quality of life for them going to be in their city? While I was living there, from the 9 years I was there off and on, I lived in a very nice neighborhood, a residential neighborhood. And while I was there, the greengrocer became an art gallery. The butcher became a glass store. Filled glass items. The bakery became a mask shop. All of these catered to tourists, and there's a couple other shops that disappeared as well. So it meant that people who lived there had to walk further to get a bottle of milk or meat or bread. There are supermarkets in Venice that you don't even see because they don't disturb the landscape. There's a small door and a huge supermarket inside some building. So I had to go to a supermarket, which was a longer walk than those little stores that I mentioned. So the neighborhoods are changing, and they haven't stopped that erosion of neighborhood amenities, the little shops. So people in Venice are concerned about that, and I say it's an open question. They're trying to attract more Venetians to live in Venice, more Italians, more anybody, to live there full time, and they're building on the edges of Venice, building comfortable living quarters for workers to stay. stay there, you see. So it's not certain what'll happen, but it's a very thriving museum tourist city, that's for sure. And but the quality of life for people full-time is still, as I say, up in the air.
Yeah. You, in the beginning, you talked about going there and wanting to go there at the time when there would not be a lot of tourists, so you went in the winter.
Yes.
And I could imagine, and I have one of my producers said, the coldest she ever felt in her life was one year when she was in a church in Venice in November. I would imagine that in the winter it might be a little on the dank side with all that water there.
It can be wonderful weather. It doesn't generally snow, occasionally. It doesn't get that cold, but there is a dampness to the cold. So that's what I think she was talking about, because when it's a damp cold, you really feel it.
Yeah.
And those churches are not heated.
Other than that, with the atmosphere in January, what's it like?
It's quieter. I mean, Venice is a very quiet city, even with all the tourists.
Yeah, because they don't have cars.
Because they don't have cars. It's also a clean city. People say, oh, the canals smell. Well, in fact, that's a bum rap. The time I was there, there were a couple of places where the canals might have smelled, but it was not a big problem for me. And also, it's a clean city because the air is clean. There's no fossil fuels being burned in Venice. It's against the law. And on the big smokestacks on the mainland, belt smoke that's blown inward, blown inland, so blown away from Venice. Venice is in the center of a lagoon. So it's quiet, it's clean, and in January, it's not all that empty of tourists. Now tourism's a year-round business, but there are fewer tourists. So you can walk through the city much more easily, even on those thoroughfares that the tourists use primarily. And you can get, because it's very frustrating during the rest of the year for people who live there to try to go somewhere, because you have to thread your way through big, knots of tourists.
Well, I mentioned right at the very beginning that you talk about the fact that when Midnight was published right away, people were saying, okay, what's going to be the next thing? Now that this book has been published and you have the two books that are, say, similar in their approach, do you feel that on the one hand, this is a kind of a thing that you'd like to continue doing, or do you feel that you've written yourself into a corner and that people then are going to expect that what you're going to do now in the future is another book that's going to be like, in a sense,
a play about a play.
Yeah.
Everyone expects that I will. I'm not so sure I will. It depends what story turns me on the most. I'm looking at some certain stories, and I'm not wedded to the idea of simply picking a place and doing that. So it could be either.
Have you ever thought about writing fiction?
No.
That doesn't appeal to you?
Not to me. To me, nonfiction is more exciting. I think if I sat down to write, to read a book, I mean, I like novels, but if someone said to me, the novel you're reading is true, I would be much more interested in the novel. So what I'm doing is nonfiction written to be read like novels, to sound like a novel, to have the dramatic pull that a novel has, but to have it be real. That, to me, is much more exciting. Mm.
Well, what then, let me ask you that, what do you think are the essentials then of good storytelling, the kind of thing that takes events and people that are real, things that really happened, and yet tells the story in a way that's compelling enough that people have, when they read it, they would be willing to believe that it would be a novel, or it has some of the power, some of the
power.
Well,
you had to have as compelling characters and a conflict or a problem that needs to be worked out, or a mystery that needs to be solved. And then you have, as you go along with those elements, you have twists and turns and suspense, surprises, that sort of thing. That's what a novel does. You have things working out or not working out, and you set up a series of questions in the reader's mind, and then as you go along, you develop those questions or answers to them in a way that draws the reader on.
Any hints at all about what you're thinking about now?
Well,
what you're doing now?
I can't give you a hint because I haven't really decided. I'm looking at a couple of stories, and one of them is not so far from my home, which is New York. So I don't know. I couldn't, if you asked me what I was going to do next, I couldn't even tell you, even privately, for sure. But I will soon make, my editor and I have agreed on a deadline for me to decide what the next book is going to be about. And that's even a secret.
Hmm.
I mean, the deadline.
Altogether, how much time did you spend in Venice while you were specifically working on this project?
Well, the period of the story is about, it's 7 years. I was in Venice about 40% of the time. I would go there for a few months at a time, come back to New York for a few months. And I wrote the book there and in New York, about a little more than half in New York, because at the very end I just sat to hunker down and in my house and wrote. And that was a little more than half of the book.
And is this a place that you expect that now you'll continue to go back to?
Oh, yes, I'll go back. I've been back once since the book came out, just for a day. The London Times asked me to go with their reporter and show them around, so I did. And, of course, the reception there is wholly different from what it had been before. People now all know about the book if they haven't read it, and they have various feelings about it, too. Some are good, some are not.
Is there an Italian version already?
Yes. Dove cadono gli angeli, where angels fall, it's called. And it was brought out a month after the American one, and it's published by Rizzoli.
Yeah. Well, I think probably about at this point we're going to have to finish up. The book is The City of Falling Angels. It's all about Venice, by our guest John Barrett. He's a journalist, former editor of New York Magazine, and author of the book Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil, which is still out there and available and you can read. It was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in General Nonfiction in 1995. The new book, City of Falling Angels, published by the Penguin Press, that's been out now just a couple of months, and certainly you can find that in the bookstore. Mr. Barrett, thanks very much.
Been a pleasure.
Programming here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. The broadcast is also made possible today with support from Christie Clinic Association, with offices in Champaign, Urbana, Rantoul, and Mahomet. Christie Clinic, medicine for your life. That's it for Focus for this morning at 11 o'clock. We'll be going to National Public Radio for the beginnings of their coverage of the Alito hearings in Washington. Right now, though, we'll do what we usually do about this time, as well, have an update on the markets.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from First Midwest Bank, serving the banking needs of Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Kathy Ferguson and Morris at 815-941-3758. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look.